Thank you for that lovely introduction. Not sure what this will do to my leveler, but we'll see. When the people at All Saints, or the interim rector at All Saints, asked me to help out with pastoral visiting, I didn't look at him with great joy. I sort of looked at him. And he said, "Is there a condition?" And I said, "Well, yes, there is. There is a condition." And he said, "What is that?" I said, "No staff meetings." And I've tried to stick with that. Thank you for the kind introduction. Like a lot of us, you think over your more active part of your career, your life, and hope I've come to a couple of conclusions. I am a great fan of Gary Hall, Father Gary Hall, who is here. And he's kind of a hero of mine. I think I've told him this. I hope so. He was dean of what's called the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. And what some of you may not know is that when he came, they had burned through much of their endowment in perhaps ill-advised investments or parking lots or whatever. And he brought him back from the brink and brought him back into a healthy congregation. So he doesn't go around talking about that, but to a lot of us, he's a really inspiring person. And I will say that he reminded me that no Episcopal male priest can speak without a blue blazer, wearing a blue blazer. Now that I've acknowledged that, I'm taking it off because I'm hot. Okay, there we are. It's your basic blue blazer, nothing special. Episcopal clergy tend to wear them everywhere. What I want to talk about today, and thank you, by the way, for coming over here and changing your habit and, you know, getting everything all goofed around. And what I want to talk about is a comment that Father Hall made about the importance of the church buildings. And if I remember, which I may not, because I too seem to be losing parts of my memory, at least I'm more inaccurate than I used to be. I'm convinced I'm right, but not always does that turn out to be true. He spoke about how during church services, we focus on the sermon, we focus on what's going on up here, but the truth is the building is more important than we know. So that's what I'd like to talk about this morning. I guess I start with just a comment on Richard Rohr. I didn't used to read him, and go ahead and steal that if that's better. I thought that might reverb a little bit. There we go. That one is for you. Okay. In my mind, Richard Rohr is something like a Roman Catholic C.S. Lewis. Okay? Because many, many people have read C.S. Lewis, especially who go on and be ordained, and then after they're ordained, they kind of forget they ever read him. Oh, yeah, he's fine. Okay? And I've kind of seen that happen with Richard Rohr. I think he is an extraordinarily good writer, but oftentimes is more appreciated openly by lay people than by clergy. Just an interesting kind of, I don't know, situation. So let's start with what I'm supposed to start with, which is the issue of recovery. Why is this a good time to recover the Trinity? And Richard Rohr gives us three or four reasons. So I'd like to give you a reason that I think this is a really good time for recovering the notion of a live Trinity interacting and self-giving and receiving. And it goes something like this. The Western civilization, all of it. I love that generalization. All of Western civilization. Okay, we'll assume that's true. Maybe. Much of Western civilization has been based on logical, rational thought. And the assumption has been that each of us is a logical, rational person making rational decisions rationally. You get my drift? Okay. But then starting about 1900, give or take, a decade or two, Sigmund Freud comes on the scene in Vienna and he starts talking about the subconscious. And all of a sudden, the foundations begin to shift a little bit. Maybe we're not so rational as we thought. Maybe there's something pushing that. And so all during the last century, and certainly in this century, what has been happening is that the culture has been moving away from philosophy and moving into psychology. And so what moves you and I and almost everyone else in our culture is no longer philosophical predicates of any kind. Do you really care how Aristotle differs from Plato? I mean, if you're into that, you might, but otherwise, probably not. One of the most famous stories, perhaps apocryphal, perhaps true, about the age of Constantine and the fight over the dogmas and the doctrines and the bishops and all of that, the bishops got into fist fights over doctrine, over theological and philosophical doctrine, to the point where Constantine called in the Praetorian Guard and said, quiet them down. And people on the streets of Byzantium and Rome would themselves get into fistfights over the relation between Jesus and the Holy Spirit and the Father. Imagine, when is the last time you got into a fistfight over philosophy? Probably not. So what's happening is the entire culture has been shifting its basis, and it's been shifting more into what I would call psychology in general, and even to the point where things that used to be far apart are coming together. There was a time when scientific research and the scientific method was absolutely anti-religious. Absolutely. They knew that all of us who had some sort of hint of religion in us were old-fashioned and just not up to date. But look at the people now who are doing scientific studies of mindfulness and studies of meditation and studies of how we pray and who come up with experimental scientific knowledge showing the effect of all of those states and what they have on our minds. By the way, I should also mention the destruction of physics. Classical Newtonian physics is now considered to work really well in a certain range, okay, known as everyday life. But subatomic physics has just taken all of that and turned it upside down. And one of the early physicists said, if you think you understand subatomic physics, you don't, because it's so different. So psychology has pushed aside the rational man. Physics has pushed aside the rational universe. And it's not quite over yet. Oddly enough, there's one academic field that's finally coming to the party. Economics. The new Nobel Prize winner in economics, is it Richard Thaler? I'm not sure I have that somewhat right. Good. Yeah, I'm seeing a nod, so maybe that's right. Got the Nobel Prize because he and two or three other people invented the entire field of behavioral economics, saying, let's study how people actually react to things instead of assuming that we're all rational, logical people looking out for our self-interest. And so the entire field of economics is now in flux and kind of fighting back and forth. But economics is finally coming to the party. We're not as rational as we thought we were. Now, I think... Good. Okay. I dropped my chin and dropped my voice all at the same time, and it scared me. Okay. There are two books, by the way, that I think really, and I'm not going to actually be referring to them too much, but they're up here. When I was up close writing it, the letters looked big, but now they look a little small, so you can come up at halftime or whatever. The first one, called The Monastery and the Microscope, is the latest book about the conversations the Dalai Lama has every two or three years with scientists. Okay? And so these, a group of maybe 20 scientists, went to, in this case, southern India, and met with the Dalai Lama for a week at one of the largest Tibetan monasteries in the world. And this is a record of their discussions. Okay? So that'll be one book, and this will be up here when you want to come write it down if you do. The other one is a book called Welcome to Your World. It also just came out. It turns out that all the work being done on mindfulness research and kind of putting those things on your head and measuring your brain waves, they're now doing it when people walk into buildings, or when people sit in buildings, or when they sit in small places, or when they sit in large places. And they're finding out that many of the things that they can pick up around meditation are also in the outside world. And this woman is talking about the design of buildings and human spaces that are more healthful for us. One example, and I bet many of you know this, they now do research with hospital patients. And if the window in your hospital room looks out on trees and grass, guess what? On the average, you get out of the hospital at least one day sooner. Imagine that. They find out that if they're able to take patients out into gardens, they heal quicker. That is, the world around us has effects on us because we're completely interconnected in ways below here. Now, that takes me back to where I want to go today. And I want us to think about all those altered states. That's my old 1960s language. Some of you may remember it. Now they call it mindfulness. But in the old days, it was altered states. And so we, at least for now, we could throw out the drugs, but they were involved. Meditation, contemplation, mindfulness, even what are called states of reverie, that's a fancy word for daydreaming. All of these things are now being studied both on the inside of us and how the outside of us produces that. So let me tell you a story about me. I'm sorry about that, but you're stuck, okay? I grew up in eastern Washington State on a wheat farm in what's called the Palouse agricultural area down by Pullman. And my people were a mixture of Irish and Bohemian and, you know, Scotch and a little English. And 98% of my little town, which was Colton, Washington, Colton and Uniontown, two little twin towns, 98% of them came from Bavaria. And they were Roman Catholic. And in those days, except for us, every family had a lot of kids, and they sent one man to be a priest and one woman to be a nun. When I ended up years later in Berkeley, California, going to seminary, the Jesuits all knew where I came from. Because they had colleagues from Colton and Uniontown, and we traded names. Oh, yeah, the Schulteises, that's right. My best friend in high school, he and I would go out on Friday and Saturday nights, hopefully to try to get into trouble. Nothing ever happened. But he couldn't go out until he made his confession, I think on Saturday night. Otherwise, he couldn't go to church on Sunday morning, right? And his parents would be very mad at him. So I would pick him up in our Buick, and very carefully, I didn't want a ticket, very carefully drive right at the speed limit to the big, dark Catholic church in Colton. Huge thing, about this size. And it got cold in the wintertime, so I would carefully go in and avoid the confessional and the line, because I didn't have anything I was going to tell a priest about, okay? I might have had, but I sure wouldn't have told him. I was hoping, maybe. And I would spend my time waiting for him as he moved up the line, out in the dark of the church. Now, this is pre-Vatican II, okay? church was dark. It was tall. It had maybe 20 statues all the way around it. And it had red little candle lights, votive lights, in front of most of the statues. And it had a reserved sacrament, for those of you who know about that, with that candlelight. And I would spend once a week in the darkness of that church. And it only occurred to me years later that that's when my conversion began. Because I paid no attention to the church that we went to. That's where my real conversion began, and it was the building that converted me. So I'm speaking here on behalf of buildings everywhere. Okay? And church services, as they used to be, and as they probably will be to some extent in the future, I think that in the early 1400-1500 years of the church, I don't know if people consciously knew what was going on, but they built themselves places of meditation and prayer, especially after Constantine, and they could move out of the houses and move into the big basilicas. And those churches worked well for that. And so I want to oppose two different kinds of design for you in church buildings and show you what we've lost. This is an interesting building because this church kind of does both. But let me talk about that. In the old days, before the Reformation, the priests would have been up here perhaps speaking in Latin or in old Slavonic, in Russia would be old Slavonic, but people might not always know the language even being spoken up here. But they would be in this space, often dark, often with candles, often with incense, a ritualized form of words that they would have recognized would have been going on, much like a river carrying them forward. And they would quit paying attention to what happened up here, right? And they might start looking at a window. By the way, I love that window. I think it's gorgeous. Notice how it pulls your eyes, okay? This room is meant to pull your eyes forward to what's happening here and to that window and to the altar, which here happens to be here, okay? And so the building's working to have you look this way. By the way, look at the roof and the Celtic cross up above. It again is pulling you up forward. And it's inviting you to go inside and pay attention to your insides. Oh, and then come back in case something important is going on up here. Always looking as if you're attentive. We all know how to sit through things, okay? But the old churches were inviting us to go inside and meditate and pray. My first church was a little mission up north of Seattle. Because I was reading all this wild stuff about altered states, I started listening to my parishioners and just asking them what I said. Forget the sermon. Yes, I know it was wonderful. Thank you for complimenting me. Yes, yes, thank you, thank you. Whatever they meant. You know, they were very polite Episcopalians, so you know. So the question was, what were they really doing? And if you sat long enough, they would tell you. So one of the first things I heard from two or three women mostly was, well, at the first part of the sermon you said something. And then all of a sudden I began to think about that and kind of look at a window and then kind of chew over what you said. Oh, and then I'd come back and you'd be almost done. Okay? Then somebody would say, well, the sunlight came through one of our stained glass windows and was on the floor making the pattern of a cross. And all of a sudden, I found myself drawn into the cross. Oh, and then we had the recessional hymn and we were on our way out. You see what's happening? See what's happening? People are taking the time in this space to go inside of themselves and to re-knit themselves from the problems of the week. That's why one of the reasons why people come back to church and then leave. Now, there are other reasons, companionship and hearing a good message and doing all kinds of things. But the old churches understood that one of the things you did was go inside your head. I don't know if they didn't talk about it very well, but that was the function of the building. By the way, that backfired on me. I was telling, especially Episcopal Church is always an early 8 o'clock and then a second service. Even if you have five people, you got to have an 8 o'clock, and it's quieter service. And I overheard one of my little old ladies saying to another one who went to the 10 o'clock service, "Well, Father Paul says we meditate." In other words, they had taken what I had told them about meditation and immediately used it as a weapon to make sure they were better than the other ladies. Can't always win. At the time of the Reformation, this traditional building changed. The building plan changed. And it wasn't that anybody was bad. It was, at the time of the Reformation, people were overwhelmed. Would you say that iPads and iPhones have transformed our world overnight? Would you say that? I would. Okay. The effect of being able to get and read books was absolutely as shattering as the effect of iPads and iPhones. People were just, it was the best thing since sliced bread and peanut butter. And it affected everything. So another example, we went on a Rick Steves tour of Europe, our first time over, and we were scared to death of the foreign languages, and so we went on the tour. And Rick Steves made you go to the airport in the Netherlands and then figure out how to take the train to Harlem, the real Harlem, not the New York Harlem, but the Netherlands Harlem. And then they'd pick you up the next day. They start the next day. So we finally made it through the airport and into the underground and got to our hotel room and decided we were too wide awake to sleep. And so we went to the cathedral there. Again, a building much like this one. But of course, in the Netherlands, that church didn't belong to the Roman Catholics anymore. It belonged to the Puritans, okay? So they took out all of the stained glass windows. They took out anything up here in the altar area. Imagine all this empty. They had chairs instead of pews, but imagine all of them turned to that wall, okay? And then he built himself a pulpit. Almost three floors. I mean, it was huge. It was just huge. Tall. And then their church services involved having one person up there give an hour and a half sermon to all the people down here. And so what had been, in my mind, a traditional church was turned into a new way of accessing God called the lecture hall. The lecture hall. And that's when the pulpits began to dominate the altars. The altars began to be put aside. And the churches turned into lecture halls. Okay? So it's not that they were out to do anything bad. It's that there was this new thing they had discovered and they were so excited they were going to make sure everybody did it. But of course, then the old use of churches faded away. So what had been a resource for people, even if implicit, just evaporated. When we go back into the room next week, you will see that a very good architect, and by the way, I happen to think this is a very good modern church, a very interesting work at compromising those two purposes. You notice how the light gives a focus to the speaker up here? Okay? So when there is a sermon, there will be a focus on that. But notice how there are things to tempt your eye all around the building. In a parish hall, you can focus one of two directions. Our speakers all tend to be, so you walk in from the street, and ahead of you is this kind of lectern and the speaker, and we're gathered around a lecture place. Okay? If you were to turn left 90 degrees, you would see on the wall a large, not here, the other room, the other room, a large two-story, three-dimensional sculpture of a cross. Have you ever noticed it? Well, that's because when they want to go in there and worship, say, maybe two things are going on at once, you simply turn the chairs and you have a focal point for worship. And the light, which we always blank out because it's behind the speaker and distracting, they open the windows, the light comes in from the side, the light comes in from the clear story up above where we enter the building, and that whole thing can be transformed into a worshipful space. And that's how the architect has worked to do both things. For those of you, there are probably some of you who are way ahead of me, but I guess I wanted to say that the other thing that affected the changing of the church buildings was not simply the Reformation. A little thing called Vatican II changed everything as well. And the focus there was, and the Roman Catholics started this, and all of the other kind of mainline denominations who could follow it, including the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church, we began to pull the altar out from the walls and gathered ourselves around it. So instead of an altar, it was more of a table. Okay, I grew up in that era, and boy, I was just 110% in favor of that. And what had been more silently and introvertedly worship turned into more extroverted, facing each other as a people of God and singing a lot together with simple songs, okay? Or what were supposed to be simple songs you could repeat. Interestingly enough, study after study after study shows that millennials prefer the old spaces. The millennials want dark churches. There's a Dominican, Roman Catholic Dominican church up in Seattle, close to the University of Washington, and it's an old, long, narrow church, pews, stained glass. And every Saturday night, they have an old mass with the priest up here. Standing room only. Standing room only. And all of them under 30. Old people would be 35. I went once and they went, I didn't know people got that old. Okay? The Episcopal Cathedral, St. Mark's, for 35 years, I bet you know about this, our musician over here, I'll bet you that you know, or if you don't, you'll find this fascinating. You can get to it online. For over 35 years, they've been having choral evensong in this massive, big, ugly old cathedral. And the kids flood it. And there's so many kids in there, they sit on the floor everywhere. And some are people dating, holding hands. And others are people sitting in the corner crying. And these six or seven, it's a male choir, men walk in, go to the back of the church, chant for a half hour, and walk out. And nobody greets them, nobody gives them a bulletin, nobody asks for money, and nobody speaks to them. And they've been filling up that church for 35 years. So there's a hunger out there for what I think this group also hungers for, and that is genuine belief and genuine depth and genuine experience of the spiritual. But we're missing part of our resources. If we don't understand that the church buildings themselves can help on this spiritual journey. Just a couple of quotes that I think illuminate this maybe. I should confess that in my mind, Richard Rohr is writing one book, and all of these are just different chapters, because I'll find something in one book, and I'll see another, and I'll love it, and it's said just slightly different. So let's try this. Let's start with this one. And of course, I didn't stay within my pages, but that's all right, I hope. Okay, this is page 122. There we are. Our explorations can't be understood with the normal mind. Rather, they are best perceived with what we call a contemplative mind, which is an alternative operating system. Deep calls unto deep, the psalmist says. And then, in a quote taken from The Naked Now, the very beginning of the book, the early but learned pattern of dualistic thinking can get us only so far. So all religions, at the more mature levels, have discovered another software for processing the really big questions, like death, life, infinity, suffering, God. And many of us call this access contemplation. It is a non-dualistic way of seeing the moment, seeing the moment. Originally, the word was simply prayer. Well, yes, Christians went on Sundays to churches and they pray. And at least part of the time, they prayed inside their head, in addition to saying the words. And they let the music, which is another way into an altered state, they let the music, they let the windows, they let the incense, they let the ritual, and occasionally they even let the sermon take them into places that made it possible for them to go back out into the world and do the hard business of living for the rest of the week. So that's the first topic. I'm skipping atonement because I agree with what Richard Rohr says, and I hate talking about judicial atonement, and I think Richard Rohr has written about it better in other places. So, yes, I agree with the author. Let's move on to the next one, okay? 2 out of 3 is not bad, okay? And I want to say a word about suffering before we come to an end here for this part of it. Just finding the right page would help. I find as I get older, not only is my memory going, but you notice how words are getting smaller? Sure. Okay. All right. Despite the fact that now this is the year 2017, I firmly believe that there is still not an acceptable explanation for suffering. I just don't think so. Every philosophical or even psychological, you know, kind of justification for suffering, just like, because I'm always confronted by somebody else suffering. And it never seems to me that I can just walk away from it saying, oh, yeah, I understand. Okay? But fortunately for us, if there is no explanation yet, number one, we hope there will be. And number two, spiritual directors know exactly how to use suffering to help us. And that's what Richard Rohr is talking about here. He's talking about, no, we don't have an explanation for suffering, but we're always learning how to live with it. And kind of the first thing that my spiritual directors off and on have put into my head is, trying to avoid suffering doesn't work. The more I try to avoid suffering, the deeper trouble I get into. Shopping is not going to help me with this. Okay. It's just not. And yet we all are busy and we're doing things and we stay active and then you can't put off dealing with suffering without killing part of yourself. I've done it over and over again. I kind of have to wake up those parts of me that have gone dead because I've tried to ignore people's suffering. And we're always in kind of this oscillation between paying attention, not paying attention. My spiritual directors pretty much, if they know what they're doing, say, no, it didn't work. You gotta somehow stay aware and conscious of suffering, yours and other people's, and also stay aware of and keep right next to it the joy of God. And we must always take joy and suffering and braid them together and keep them both in our consciousness, keep them both in our awareness, weave them in together, because that's how we both go deeper and quit being superficial, which is perhaps what gives clergy license to preach, because we're very fluent, but we're not always right or deep. But if we can keep suffering and joy together, somehow we're not only capturing what's going on in the Trinity, we're also capturing what's really going on in our spiritual lives, and it takes us deeper and gives us more understanding of the Trinity. You go down, and then you go up. The Eastern Orthodox have a very interesting take on this. They have a thing called the gift of tears. Some of you have heard that maybe? They think that if you begin to cry seriously about your sins, it's a release. It releases somehow those sins. And penthos is, it's often translated as sorrowful joy. Sorrowful joy. And so there's a sense in which they're not avoiding suffering. They're repenting of their own screwed upness. I don't think that's a theological word, but you know what I mean. They're kind of sorrowing over it. But at the same time, they're not just wallowing in it, because they're weaving it right into the joy that comes from God. And keeping those things together, I think, is what Richard Rohr is talking about. And I think it's the hard challenge we all have, or the gift. I'm not sure sometimes if the church is a gift or a challenge or a hard effort or absolutely free, but it's all of those things, maybe. One of the things that I think we can do, and perhaps should do. The first session of this book, I was sitting at a table, and somebody was telling me that they're really tired of the Christian church because it's always about suffering, suffering with Jesus, and suffering, suffering. And I remembered it took me back, really, to when I was a kid. And yes, they were always talking about suffering, and we should be suffering, and did you suffer enough today, and did you suffer with Jesus? And that can become pretty old. But what's interesting is when we look at the Buddha, what is the first thing the Buddha says? Life is suffering. Dukkha, I think the word is. It's suffering. It's frustration. That the life of Jesus and his death and resurrection, and then the instruction from the Buddha to pay attention to suffering, it seems to me those are much the same. But of course, the Buddha then turns right around and says a few metaphysical things about disconnecting. But then he says, but then we must come to, is it metta? Loving kindness. The response to suffering is loving kindness. And the Bodhisattva, if I have that right, always saying, I won't go into heaven till I bring everybody with me. What an amazing statement. I will work, I will stay here and work for the saving, the health, the retrieving of every sentient being. And I have a strong sense, and I think this is why the Roman Catholics have this understanding, I will not call it a doctrine, but an understanding, that the saints in heaven continue to be concerned about us in some way that we don't understand. In some way that we don't understand, the other side, which is just very close to us, cares about us and is not ignoring us. So that's the little dab I have to say about suffering. And you notice that we have a lit candle, because that's what you should do in a holy place. Keeping joy and suffering together, and getting to joy and suffering by using alternate states, by using non-rational ways of getting there. I think all of those different states are healing. One story I was telling Tom in my church in Seattle, an old stone church like Trinity here, we had a gentleman in his 80s, close to 90, and he had had a marvelous life as an attorney in town. He had been a hero to many people because he was the first white attorney to bring blacks into acceptability, if you will, into the professional classes and into the legal profession in any numbers. But he had been a staunch, not just agnostic, but atheist his whole life. Fiercely atheist. Never darkened the door of a church. Okay? And then he went into a retirement home, and as these things happened, he found a lady friend. You know how this works at any age. And she was one of our Episcopalians. Well, that's a good way to convert people, isn't it? And so he agreed that he would come to a church service and she could sit wherever she wanted to. He was sitting in back pew. Okay, that's as far in as he would come. And our church, like I suspect this one, had a magnificent organ. And for some reason, our organist always liked to do Bach. I have no idea why that should be, but anyway, there it was. And as I walked out, in the postlude, I looked over, and he was just crying copiously. Okay? As soon as the music was over, he quit. And he never said anything much, except one thing. He said, "I don't want you to be thinking this makes me a Christian. I still don't believe any of that stuff." They would come every Sunday, and he would cry during the prelude and the postlude and the hymns. But he would never talk about it. So I want to say to you, he was an atheist from here up. Okay? Of course it's nonsense. We know lots of people like that. But what was he from here down? He was somebody who was overwhelmed by the spiritual realities he had repressed for, 70 years? He came bubbling up. So I say to you, these altered states, these meditative states, the mindfulness, the stuff we're trying to do here, the insights we're trying to have here, all of the work that you're doing here by having people come and take our belief deeper, thank you. Because you're helping all of us. And now it's time to walk all the way over there and have some munchies. All right? Thank you.